Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is Thursday, September 1st, 2005. Today's session is entitled Grounded in the Holy, Knee Deep in Mary Oliver's Mud, presented by Jan Bowman, number BOJ 2005-03.
This kind of opens up the world for her. Actually, I don't need this chair.
Well, if you need one for a table, we got lots of chairs.
She's the winner of the Pulitzer Prize, as well as the National Book Award, and several other awards for her poetry. And one critic says that she communicates the beauty she finds in the world and makes it unforgettable. This line, well, it's actually the third line on the board, but the first one by Mary Oliver, "A lifetime isn't long enough for the beauty of this world," is from the poem Flare, which introduces A Leaf and a Cloud. And I like it so much that I used it as the epigraph for my book of poetry that I published this spring. And Karen, who wrote the foreword, suggested that I use it as the epigraph for the whole book, and I should have done that. You know, it was just a really good idea, but I was so far along in the process that I couldn't ask the publisher to make one more change. And then another one I wrote up there is from a poem we're going to look at today, "I don't want to end up simply having visited this girl." I have a little book of essays at home by Oliver in which she describes the three rules she uses for writing her own poems. The first is, it must have a genuine body. The second, sincere energy. And third, a spiritual purpose. So once again, a genuine body, sincere energy, and a spiritual purpose. And I find that a very intriguing triad for a poet to set up for her own work. She also says that a poem should indicate a life lived with intelligence, patience, passion, and whimsy.
Could you say those again?
Yes. A life lived with intelligence, patience, passion, and whimsy. I think Holden Village is a place where we enjoy the combining of some of those ingredients, right?
Yeah.
I think intelligence and whimsy, you know, there's so much that lifts the mind and the spirit here, but there's also a lot of whimsy, and maybe that goes into accomplishing that rising of the spirits. It should also ask something. The poem should ask something, and at its best moments, I want the question to remain unanswered. The reader's part is to answer. In my own writing of poetry, I fight the tendency to provide the answer, to give the moral to the story. Victorian literature was my specialization, and there's got to be a moral to the story, right? Or at least a moral dilemma, right? Maybe not entirely answered. But that's what she wants to set up, a question to remain unanswered. And the last note I've taken here about what she wants in a poem is that it must have a pulse, a breathiness, some moment of earthly delight. Mm-hmm. So starting with that, let's look at the poem that inspired me to write up that description for today, called Rice.
The guidelines you mentioned, are those ones that you have discerned for writing, or has she written herself with those?
That's a quotation from this book of essays.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. There are enough? Okay. Now, I would like to invite any and all of you to be readers of the poems that we talk about today. So, would anyone like to start us off by reading Rice?
Thank you. Rice. It grew in the black mud. It grew under the tiger's orange paws. Its stems thinner than candles and as straight. Its leaves like the feathers of egrets, but green. The grains cresting, wanting to burst. Oh, blood of the tiger. I don't want you just to sit down at the table. I don't want you just to eat and be content. I want you to walk out into the fields where the water is shining and the rice has risen. I want you to stand there, far from the white tablecloth. I want you to fill your hands with blood, like a blessing.
Let's start with any images or phrases that present problems for us that maybe don't seem to fit in the poem or, speaking of energy, has an energy that we don't quite understand.
Blood of the tiger for me. Okay.
Blood of the tiger? Anything else?
Stems thinner than candles. Seems up there a lot.
Okay. Anything else?
It grew in under the tiger's orange.
Yeah. So we have the tiger under the tiger's orange paws, and oh, the blood of the tiger, as if that were almost some sort of culmination of that thought. Okay. Now I'm not sitting here with the answer. Remember that.
Yeah. The tiger in it at all is very startling. I kind of wonder about it. I mean, I think the most obvious is its connection to rice grown in Asia, where tigers live. Mm-hmm. But we have rice grown in this country too.
We do.
So,
a lot of rice grown around Sacramento in California. Mm-hmm. I don't know of any tigers there, but maybe I'm just hoping.
Well, it provides that sense of energy that the crop itself may not hold to the casual observer, but the thought of a tiger marching around in it, then there's a lot of energy.
But her breathy, oh, blood of the tiger at the end of that first stanza is
the color of that. I mean, you've got, you're thinking of white and you've got some green, but then all of a sudden that, I don't know, that color, which you assume is red, jumps out.
Let's just notice all the colors in that first stanza. Because rice is, what is rice? It's pearly white, isn't it? Yeah. Some wild rice is black and brown, but what are the colors that you see?
Well, the black that of the mother at the bottom where it grows up from.
Black, orange, white and green, and the yellow and black of a tiger. Hi, Naomi. Hi.
There's a seat for you right here.
I actually need to work at a table, so I'm just eavesdropping.
I can imagine a spectacular oriental painting with these colors spread around.
What color are egrets' feathers?
They're usually white.
White.
Usually white.
Almost a shocking white. No, we need to look on for this one because we really want to.
You did take that one. No, listen. I liked how she juxtaposed the presence of the egret and then moving to the verb cresting. Egrets always have a crest. And be that careful in her detail.
You see, there's, and then there's dots, and then all of a sudden, the rest at the very top, that's just so full that it wants to pop open. And it's right.
So is she borrowing from the tiger? You know how tigers approach the prey. Is she borrowing from the energy of the tiger and a kind of secret? It's almost a secret energy to me, the stealth, you know, to say something about the way the grains burst into life. Do you think that could be part of it? Oh, the blood. Like this is life blood, like this is the blood of everything that's growing.
She ends with that blood of the tiger and then starts saying, I don't want you. And I'm assuming that means us or who's ever reading this. But I wondered if the creatureliness of the tiger, if she was including us with that tiger. The rice grows up under our feet as well. And we aren't careful on the earth. You know, we crush it or we harvest it or use it in some way, and this poem is an admonition to just not take it for granted, not take being able to eat rice for granted.
It's a good day to talk about this poem. I mean, I'm glad linked it to the potatoes we were having. Somehow, when we have the hunger awareness meal at Holden, it's never really felt like deprivation to me, because there's always a way in which it's made interesting. But supposing we had been given just one little tablespoon of rice.
Next Thursday.
Much out of
that.
Well, that meal is intended, isn't it, to connect us with the whole process of what is required to bring that meal to the table.
Well, when tigers have blood, then they're dead. And when you're dead, then you turn into mud. Maybe then make that connection.
Last night, wasn't Pastor Larry talking about the red clay, connecting that with life blood and so on?
I wonder if the blood of the tiger feeds the earth.
All right,
and fertilizes.
Is anyone familiar with what a rice paddy, what a single plant actually looks like how large it is? Because it's, it might help with the visualization.
Right. Is anyone, have you ever walked into a rice field, a rice paddy?
We can buy one on a train, but that doesn't help as far as size goes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, part of the plant is growing underwater, so it's hard to see how high it is. Our closest contact with it is that we have he's like a nephew to us, Peter Brostrom, who worked for a long time on growing organic rice, you know, out in the fields. And we got some of the sense of the difficulty of the work. You know, we may think that rice grows up very easily, but of course it's attacked by all kinds of pests, you know, like everything else. And so it's not a simple thing. I'm sorry I can't provide the illustration of this. And I'm not even enough of a botanist to be able to describe the plant for you.
Does anybody, I'm having a senior moment, I can't remember his name, but Tiger, Bernie, Frank.
Blake.
William Blake.
Yeah.
Could she be borrowing from that energy because she loves Blake?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Kind of an Asian element to the energy that's there. We had a tiger get loose from a man who had kept some exotic animals in our neighborhood, the larger neighborhood. And it was on the loose for a week or so. And it just, everyone was aware of this tiger spirit that was stalking around. And
there were photographs of these huge paw prints, you know, in the newspaper. Apprehension heightened.
And the egret is kind of a mythical bird too, isn't it?
It's in a lot of Egyptian art, isn't it?
But she seems to, in the last line, saying that the real power, fertility, is in the mud. Mm-hmm. I mean, for rice is so often taken as a rather bland, and yet it's the energy of Asia.
Mm-hmm. It is, yeah.
I get the picture of actually walking out to the rice paddy with bare feet and a hat. Mm-hmm. You're out there with nothing but the rice and the sky. Mm-hmm. And then answering you her good words. I can actually imagine lifting, sticking that, reaching down and getting wet and having it slip through your fingers.
So you can feel the poem. That's wonderful. I think that means that she succeeded with you, that you can enter the poem.
Get out of the house and get out with the rice paddy field. Mm-hmm.
So it's probably quite literal, isn't it? Mm-hmm. She really wants us to get into the mud. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think the tiger image for me, after rereading it a couple times, is the tiger's wild. Mm-hmm. And the rice has been domesticated.
Right.
And it kind of brings the wildness of the grain. You know, it's still a wild in that it's a living being. Mm-hmm. And the wildness of imagine, I don't know how to put it into words. I think that's a successful poem too. But the tiger brings the rest of creation into looking at that stem of rice with the greens bursting. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think you're right. She's left us with a puzzle that can't really be solved, and that's good because I've heard people talk about the east and the west in this poem, you know, of the bestial or the animal and the tamed. You know, there's a lot of opposites going on here. And maybe, I mean, one thing I thought of in reading that is that this mud of blessing is a way of saying that all of that is a blessing. You know, that we share this common element. We come from it. Our food comes from it. When you think of the world's population, did any of you go to Dick Ojakangas' presentation? Mm-hmm. See that population
video?
Wasn't that? And you see China and Asia, you know, one little dot of light represented a million people from the beginning of recorded history, I guess. And the explosion of population started early in those places. Well, what is the staple in those countries? So,
well, and then a little bit what she's done, I didn't think of it until just this minute, but when she's asking us to get down and put our hands into that from which it comes, from which we come, it fits with Holden's theme about taking off your shoes,
doesn't it?
You know, she's using hands here, but she wants you in it, touching it.
That's right.
Connected.
Feeling it, connected with it.
Connected, yeah.
When I started reading from her collected poems for this session, I was just amazed at all the poems I could have used, you know, because it is written all over her poetry. Let's turn to another one now.
Could I ask a question? Why is it that when we're children, we love to play in the mud?
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
And then as adults, we are so careful not to be in the mud. And
Not get dirty,
and
we stopped at a rest stop on our way north, and there was this little boy. What do you think he was about? He had just learned to walk, I think.
Yeah.
And they had watered the lawn, you know, and it formed a nice little mud puddle. And his parents just let him You know, the look of wonder on his face. Oh, it wasn't really a smiling wonder. It was just, I don't know.
Yeah.
How would you describe it, Jerry?
Just kept like he was hypnotized. Pop. You sat there worrying about, oh, he's going to sit down in it.
Oh, yeah, you know, all dirty, you know, his parents.
There's a story in my family that my mom used to tell, and she's gone now, so she can't tell it. But it is about us kids little on the farm, and the neighbor comes over, and there has been rain. So out in the farmyard, between the barns and the house where we drive, usually are the little indentations, yeah. And it's filled with water. And my sister and brother are out there in our little underpants playing it. And we are all muddy. Uh-huh. And this neighbor comes in and says, Lorna, do you know that your children are out in the yard and they're really dirty? They're getting all wet. And Mom just looked at him and grinned and said, yeah, I know. She sent us out to play.
I'm also really struck by the contrast of the mud and the white tablecloth.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, how could you get further apart in our consciousness?
Yeah. You see that tablecloth and it's all pristine with the white, and then you go and the mud and get dirty.
Mm-hmm. And the white egret.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, I can tell right away that this group could spend the entire hour and a half on this. Well, let's look at one here that I chose because I knew we were going to be in the woods. Maybe not the pine woods. Do you call this? Well, there's another one on the sheet, which I don't think we'll go into right now, but 5 a.m. in the pine woods. And you probably have to share. I'm thrilled with the turnout, but I do think that.
That's all right. We can share.
Would someone like to read this poem?
I will. I'd seen their hoofprints in the deep needles and knew they ended the long night under the pines, walking like two mute and beautiful women toward the deeper woods. So I got up in the dark and went there. They came slowly down the hill and looked at me sitting under the blue trees. Shyly they stepped closer and stared from under their thick lashes and even nibbled some damp tassels of weeds. This is not a poem about a dream, though it could be. This is a poem about the world that is ours, or could be. Finally, one of them, I swear it, would have come to my arms, but the other stamped sharp hoof in the pine needles like the tap of sanity, and they went off together through the trees. When I woke, I was alone. I was thinking, so this is how you swim inward, so this is how you flow outward, so this is how you pray.
Read that from your chalet or lodge porch as the deer are coming up to you in the morning. Or out on the trail, better yet, right?
One interesting thing is she never names the creature.
Yeah.
You know, we have to imagine and see it.
It's so easy.
Yeah.
Is it clear to most people that they are in fact deer?
That's what I imagined anyway.
I was seeing horses.
Yeah, and be horses.
Well, they have hooves, right?
Yeah.
But she says walking with the pines, the long grasses, so that makes me think of the deer. And then when they stab the sharp hoof and the pine needles, that makes me think of deer.
And deer do that. They stamp in warning. And, horses do too, though.
Yeah, but it reminded me of Robert Frost, the poem "To Me Too," and the deer.
Mm-hmm. Jerry, experience. Brother Richard was up here in the summer of 89 with us, and I think he taught a couple of sessions on tithing. Did he?
Yeah.
Could you say a word about tithing? I can if you don't want to.
Well, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I can't remember the history of it, but I know that it comes from an ancient practice of receiving the soul of the other creature. And most of our looks toward creatures are what? How do we look at them?
Frightened,
yeah.
Or surprised.
Surprised.
Odd.
Cute. Or are they cute, yes.
Or get away.
Get away, yeah, shoo. Could be
or
curious. Mm-hmm. So in tithing, you relax that sense, you know, your initial reaction, and allow its spirit to come into you. It sounds very Native American. It comes from Native people.
I know it comes from Scotland.
Yeah, I was going to say Celtic. Yeah, probably.
How's the word spelled? I have trouble if I can't picture something.
Mm-hmm. K-Y-T-H-I-N-G. Hiding.
Got it.
Huh?
Madeline Langle used that concept in her Swiftly Floating Planet Nest children's series.
Yes, she did. Good for you for remembering that.
I just read it.
Oh, did you? Yeah. So I think there's something of that in here. Not that she knows about kiting or is thinking about that, the poet that is, but when she says, finally, one of them, I swear it, would have come to my arms. And I know from other poems she has written that she is not simply an observer of nature. She's a recipient, and that creatures live, as we like to say, you know, in their own right. They have their own place. It sounds like an idealistic and pretty little concept, right? But I mean, I think she actually practices it. Probably not with the bears she means. Although she has some poems about bears.
Where does she live?
I believe she lives in Maine now. She's lived most of her life on the East Coast.
In response to that, living here for a long time, we get to see a lot of animals. And we get to see them in a state where they're not so afraid of us. Mm-hmm. And we are not so shocked and in awe. I mean, every day we see the deer. Mm-hmm. And some years, every day, we see the bears on the grass in front of the house.
Really?
Like a dog. Yeah, they'll come and eat the grass in front of them because they're hungry. Mm-hmm. And they know they're not going to get hurt here. They'll get chased, but they know they'll not get hurt. Mm-hmm. And so there's a chance for that kind of thing to happen, seriously. Mm-hmm. Because you're meeting each other in a less fearful and more routine than usual way than if we're in suburbia.
So tell us of your last eye-to-eye bear encounter.
Huh?
When you look deeply into her eyes.
Well, yeah. I can tell you of an interesting one. It was one of the years when the berries were not plentiful like they are this year, and so there were bear around a lot. And there happened to be a bear in our backyard, Chalet 8, and there's screened-in porches in the back. So I had a friend who had lived here for a while, and she wanted to get a picture. We're not supposed to go up to the bears. That's a no-no. But she came into the screened-in porch. You know, the bear was like 10 feet off of the back stairs there, munching away, eating, and she opened the door, no, with her camera and leaned out to take a picture, and the bear, just like a dog guarding its food, would look down there and went back to eating. And the little tiny beady eyes were like, just, you know, just like a dog would be. And no, I haven't looked into the eyes of a bear, but that's probably the most interesting thing I have to say about
This reminds me of the experience I had here at Holden 26 years ago. We had a solitude day. So nobody talked to each other, and we were encouraged to find solitude. And I walked on the old path toward Ten Mile Falls, back in the woods, and I was about halfway out to Ten Mile Falls, and all of a sudden there were two buck deer walking toward me. You know, I just stopped still, and I too had the feeling that if I just stood there, they were going to come right into my arms, except I was scared. You know, these were not little spotted fawns. They had a couple of fairly big bucks. But they got, I suppose, within about 20 feet of me, and then just quietly turned away and grazed elsewhere. But it was so exciting. But I wasn't kiting. I was big-eyed, you know, like a deer in the headlamps myself. Because I was scared.
Uh-huh. And they aren't about to move off the path often for you.
Yeah, that's right.
They'll stand there and you decide what you're going to do.
Stood still and let them, it was their territory.
I'm just interested in where she says it would have come into, one of them would have come into my arms. If she'd brought this poem to my poetry workshop, I think I would have asked her, why didn't you just say it would have come to me? Mm-hmm. Why did she get that particular? Because even in the rhythm of reading it, I swear one of them would have come to me, but the other.
Come to me, well,
see an even more intimate, talking to approach, but not to actually embrace. Mm-hmm. So even that could be
I wonder why she calls the stamp sharp hoof the tap of it, of sanity.
Because I think the deer is warning its partner that don't do that, you know, don't go into her arms. Uh-huh. And so she says, straighten out. Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. You don't know what you're getting into. Yeah.
The super ego took over.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure all deer or horses have super egos.
Mm-hmm. Or hinting at that warning, don't cross the kiving line.
Yeah.
The,
mm-hmm.
You know, stay here on our side.
I do have a brief deer thing that this just has reminded me of now. At the risk of speaking too much, I think it's worth sharing.
Sure.
I was walking up in back of a garbo dock one day in the spring, and I was maybe in the midsummertime. And there was a doe and two fawns crossing maybe 20 feet up the road from me. And an aggressive doe came into the scene. And one of the fawns sprung into the forest, way, way that way. And guess what? The other one came bounding, as they do, right to me. Right to me. Stopped 3 feet away, turned away from me, and was looking at the aggressive deer, shaking.
Oh,
that one came into my arms.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it really happened. This is a real thing.
Better,
like she says,
you better capture that.
Mm-hmm. Well,
on paper.
She already did.
No, do your own. On paper.
I tell the story, and I think this probably really happened to her.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But you added the shaking. That's important. Let's go to the last stanza now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking, so this is how you swim inward. So this is how you flow outward. So this is how you pray. Mm-hmm. That touched you, didn't it? I could see that. What do you think of that?
Should we back up to when I woke, I was alone?
Yeah, right.
She said it was not about a dream earlier, and then she says, when I woke. Why did she do that?
Woke from what?
I think it's more when I came back to myself.
Yeah.
It's connected to that tap of sanity of the deer on the other side.
Came out of my reverie of what had happened, what I had witnessed with the deer.
Yeah.
Reverie is a good word.
Back to being fully conscious of what had happened. Mm-hmm.
As you describe her being a person who walks a lot, she's probably acknowledging that something else happened on this walk. She wasn't just noticing mm-hmm. in her usual way. Mm-hmm.
What is her definition of prayer?
Feels to me like what she was also saying in the previous poem, right? Mm. That you need to be in touch mm-hmm. with the things of the world mm-hmm. instead of sitting down at the meal and not thinking how this rice got there or looking at deer in a zoo. Mm-hmm. You are sort of embracing the elemental mm-hmm. aspects of here it's creatures, there it was the life-giving mud. And that's kind of prayer.
Yeah, it's Yvonne Jabara has written some books about the environment and connecting it to the lives of poor women. Mm-hmm. And in one of her books called Longing for Running Water, she comes to the conclusion that God is related. God is like the matrix, the web, or, you know, but she goes beyond that really to describe the intricacies of our relationship to all living things and theirs to ours. And Kristen just showed me a photograph of a beautiful silk banner she has made, which is now in Austin at the exhibit of her work. And I don't know if you'd say a word about it. Would you mind saying a word about it? Because I think it's...
Which one is that?
The one with Holy Spirit and only the, you know, like God and Jesus. I don't know. It's a Trinitarian, but also cosmic view of the interrelatedness.
It's really concentric circles, and the outermost circle is God embracing everything, and one arm is night and one is day, like that, and then inside of that is another embracing figure with a crown of thorns, and on one side the city and one side the mountains and the river of life in the middle, and then inside that embrace is the Holy Spirit breathing into another embrace, which is two people embracing. And then within that embrace, one of them is holding what should be a child, that is the earth. Mm-hmm. So it's all one big embrace.
That's but there's a lot of inner and outward mm-hmm. flow in it, don't you think? I mean, it's okay, let's try another poem now. Let's look at another poem. I want to be sure to look at when death comes before we go, but some of you enjoyed hearing Wild Beast this morning, or a few of the favorite poems.
If you were going to suggest one volume of her poetry, that would be a good sense.
I would get this one, because it comes with new and selected poems. It has a different cover now in the new edition of it. It has a picture. I think it's for her, and it's sort of grayish purple. But Sherry and I would also recommend the Leaf in the Cloud. The Leaf in the Cloud. I want to read something from this before we leave, if possible.
And what was the woman who you were quoting? I'm having a menopause moment. where it's all relatedness, God is all relatedness. Is that a
mm-hmm. I'll write her name on the board. She's a Brazilian nun, and she works with the poorest of the poor women and children in Recife, which is up in the north.
Is that where Dom Helder comes from?
Yvonne Jabara. She's also written a book called love out of the depths, women, evil, and salvation. That's a trinity for you. Okay, who would like to read Wild Geese?
You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things.
I want to tell you how lovely it is to hear the poems read in your voice and how they change each time that happens. For me, you know how it changes so much. Now, as I read this poem in the shelter of my chalet room this morning before coming down for Matins, I read it at Matins. I started to sob. It was one of those times when I had no idea where that was coming from. Now, I could think of a lot of reasons, but maybe you could help me. What is it that brought me to tears over reading this poem aloud and knowing that I was going to read it at Matins?
One of the things that strikes me here particularly is that when she says, tell me your, what is the word she uses?
Despair,
and I'll tell you mine. I find that's something that happens here for me more than any place else, is we have the time. There seems to be a trust that, I mean, we've only been here a few days, but it's as if we dare to do that to one another, and maybe that's part of what that was saying for you as well.
Mm-hmm. Very good. That helps me.
It's also a very forgiving poem. I think when you read it, it's telling you that, you know, all the things that you may feel guilty about are not that important. Mm-hmm. The world is still out there in the same, it's the same world that you knew as a child, and it still beckons to you, and you can still go to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a comforting message.
I love that part. You do not have to be good. I mean, how
often
as a parent and as a teacher, I maybe didn't say be good, but I meant be good.
Yeah.
You don't have to be good. And I love this part. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves.
Oh, I love those blurry lines.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting she didn't say, tell me about your despair, and I'll tell you about mine. That she said, tell me about despair. And I think it's maybe pointing out that it's always in one person, it's always in a human. Each of us have our own despair. There's no meta despair that we can stand away from. It's always a person making.
Mm-hmm. Trying to track. Track this, that of despair, and then the response is that I think of times when I'm in despair, and then to look at the whole creation, it makes it look rather small.
Mm-hmm.
But not only that's somewhat of a judgment on our despair, but then it turns it around. The world then gives the gift to our imagination to be connected.
Mm-hmm.
And those last two lines announcing your place in the family of things is such a contrast to the first two lines, which is the way we often think of our place, is to be good and be repentant. And this ends with those geese reminding us that we are a part of the natural world that created order.
I kind of like that she chose geese as her image for family and migration, because we all have some familiarity with wild geese, because now they're kind of tame and bothersome and in the way, and we're cleaning up after them or moving them out of our parks, and they are still wild geese. They're just becoming accustomed to us. And but wild geese as birds, there are often two adults, and then the small ones, and they stay together for a long time. You see them as tiny little downy ones with those parents, but you also see them with the gangly teenager years geese. And they're often, if they've managed to survive, still the two adults. And once in a while, when the family's been decimated, you'll see the two adults and one teeny one scrunched between the others. I mean, ducks wouldn't have worked as well.
Have any of you seen the film
Winged Migrations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you see that?
I think I did, but yeah. I kind of forgot.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I forgot that I saw that.
I was struck by the three times she used the word meanwhile.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
It's almost as if, you know, when we get caught up in ourselves, there's this.
Right. It reminds me of Auden's poem Musée des Beaux-Arts, because, without going into the whole poem, it's an image of Icarus with the wings, the wax is holding together, you know, the fabricated wings falling into the sea. And the farmer goes on plowing the field, you know, the dog goes on scratching his behind.
Meanwhile, yeah.
Meanwhile, you know, and there's genocide in the Sudan, but meanwhile, you know, I'm going out to buy groceries again, and it sounds like a casual word. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, you know, but it's not at all casual, is it?
That word really comes into play right now. We are here in this peace and this beauty. Meanwhile, everything is lasting.
Yeah, I found it interesting that she used the word harsh about the call of the geese. And it is a kind of a honking, kind of abrupt thing, but it's totally different from the harshness of walking on your knees through 100 miles of sand. The sort of being good, the harshness that happens when we're pummeling ourselves morally or psychologically or physically.
Right.
There's a harshness in the natural order, but it's a good harshness here instead of a bad one.
Funny story about Jerry and me. And we rented a little cottage in the western part of Ireland near Croagh Patrick, St. Patrick's Mountain, where people every year, you've probably seen films or done it yourself, climb this mountain for a pilgrimage. And 80-year-old women climb it barefoot, and I couldn't get halfway up the mountain, you know, in the best of conditions. People even climb it on their knees, you know, and I'm thinking, what is wrong with me? Well, obviously, I don't think that I have to climb this mountain to be good. But there have been plenty of ways in my life in which I have felt I have to do things to be good. Well, thank you for all your insights into that poem. Here's a when Bell comes, and after we look at this, if there's time, I'd like to read from Flair a little bit of this new, or relatively new book. If I have closed that discussion, just as one of you was about to say something, please jump in here, okay? I don't want to cut off you. Okay. Is everyone ready for this poem? Who would like to read it?
When death comes like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me and snaps that purse shut, when death comes like the measle pox, when death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades, I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood, and I look upon time as no more than an idea, and I consider eternity as another possibility, and I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular, and each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending as all music does towards silence, and each body a lion of courage and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say, all my life, I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I had made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. I love that last line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sure. I don't know the exact quote, but I think it echoes to a passage from Walden, mm-hmm. where he says, I don't want to come to the end of my life.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you for thinking of that. What stands out for you in this poem? What reaches out to your imagination?
Well, I really understand the music tending towards silence. My husband's a professional musician, and I had to sit in a jazz club listening to jazz one time many years ago. And I'm a casual classical musician, so I think jazz is all cacophony. But I heard Wayne Shorter play trumpet, and I finally understood jazz because he had these incredible spaces between his honking on his trumpet. Perfect spaces.
Wayne Shorter.
This is jazz trumpet guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
What struck me was, when it's over, I want to say I was, all my life, I was a bride married to amazement.
Yeah,
I like
that.
That's
pretty close to your
experience.
Yeah.
That's my middle name. Amazement.
But you know, when you're married, you're committed.
Yeah.
Not very many of us are committed to amazement. We want everything to be, at least I do, I love everything to be normal, rhythmic,
No surprises, everything's fine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But do we want to be married to boredom?
Really intrigued by calling death the cottage of darkness. Mm-hmm. Like you open the door and walk in. Mm-hmm. And
a cottage is cozy.
And but then the reality of death is what even sharpens the focus of living on this earth even more. Is that?
Mm-hmm. It does indeed. Cottage sounds kind of cozy, though, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. It's kind of a surprising image for me. Mm-hmm. Anybody read Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And isn't death depicted with his big square toes when death comes with his big square toes? I've been thinking about that book because Lake Pontchartrain, flooded the area, and there's definitely a flood in that stream.
I just get chills reading that about the iceberg. Yeah. As an Alaskan, I think how.
Yeah, that's what me. It just kind of gives me the chills.
No. Mm-hmm. Iceberg's high. Mm-hmm. The glacier is there, and I just.
I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular. Reminds me of the Little Prince.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. There are many, many flowers that are essentially just the same, but if you spend time with one flower, if you get to know one flower, it becomes special.
Mm-hmm. And Wordsworth's, the meanest flower that grows brings sighs too deep for tears. You know that mm-hmm. one?
She just, that first set of things, I mean, this would be a kind of wonderful imaginative exercise for any of us to think when death comes, how do you picture it? Mm-hmm. And, write it down. I just think it's quite fascinating and quite stark. Mm-hmm. Death coming, taking the bright coins from the purse, buying me, and snapping the purse shut. I don't know quite what she means by that. I guess it just happened instantly.
It comes from mythology, that idea of the gold coins and the purse. But I can't remember which, can anyone remember which myth that is or which culture? Is it Russian or?
Oh, I'm not sure, but they used to bury people with a coin.
The coin
was it in their mouths or over their eyes, something like that, to pay.
Across
the river.
Mm-hmm. Huh. We saw that in Youngstown, Ohio.
A good Czechoslovakian
Lutheran church.
Yeah.
John the mother of the family had died, and the sons came up and put coins in a purse in the coffin. They closed it.
Go ahead.
Okay. With those sayings about death, I'm reminded of the book, The Denial of Death, by
So-and-so.
That underneath all of life and all of life is the reality of death, and that the human dilemma is to deny that. Mm-hmm. And then I see how she really is counter to that. Mm-hmm. She just says, when death comes, this is what I want to do.
Mm-hmm. So is it a poem about death or about life primarily?
I think life, because it's and therefore mm-hmm. I look upon. Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. of that, I then hear and know.
you think of this as a poem that you could share with people who have recently experienced the death? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about my sister-in-law, and I think that I would.
I think the timing is important.
Yes, and the people or the person.
If this is given too close to the loss, it wants to move you more quickly toward, doesn't give quite the right time in grief that a person needs, I think, if someone had recently died.
Yeah.
Ernst Becker.
Ernst Becker!
Oh, Mr. So-and-so.
Mr. So-and-so. Well, Dan, you're going to do something on St. Francis tomorrow, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, what do you think of the stanza, "Therefore I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood"?
Yeah, that reminded me of that. So, brother, earth, and sister, man, and
his images, and thou most kind and gentle death that comes to still my
final breath.
Final breath.
Yeah, it's
that has a different.
A little different, but it's still applies.
And that's a. It's rather distant paraphrase, from the. But I forgot what the original is. I have, but I'll show it to you.
And the line about time being no more than an idea, I remember reading an article where Stephen Hawking is this amazing
quantum
physicist from England, was writing and talking about time, and I was trying to follow how he understood it or how he was trying to explain, but basically this is what he was trying to get at.
Yeah.
And I could hardly make my brain realize it. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how to, that we impose the hours mm-hmm. and the minutes, and that time isn't passing mm-hmm. in the way that we think it is. Time just is. I mean, mm-hmm. yeah,
that's
it just
right.
is.
And yet, mm-hmm. even at Holden, you know,
yeah. oh,
ring the bell, it's
we
time for those.
Live by it at Holden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But even with that, you know, this line is what's attracting me. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I have made of my life something particular and real. So, you know, thinking about time not existing, do we impose that time to help us get particular and real? Or, you know, what's that all about?
Yeah.
Or how do we make of our lives something particular and real? Intentional. How do we live intent with intent?
Well, part of that could be, if time is an idea, then I accomplished this much in this period of time, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's, she's saying that if you're so concerned about time as something, that's what you make of your life, what you accomplish within a certain time, then you haven't really done anything more than visited this world. Jerry,
what was wrong.
How do you know?
Well, I was thinking about Kristen as a visual artist, and then I realized that the sentence was, I don't want to wonder if I have made of my life something particular and real.
Yeah. One of you said it on the billboard where you said, I used to play flute and recorder, and now I, whatever,
mm-hmm.
and I love that.
Mm-hmm.
It says the same thing.
Yeah.
I'm struck again by the last line, is the difference between visiting and making a home.
Mm-hmm.
Being, you know.
Yeah, being.
Mm-hmm.
A visitor, you look at your watch as to when you're going to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we are a culture that values doing all the mm-hmm. time, and we are, even in our faith lives,
mm-hmm.
that's a big emphasis. And so to just be is often discounted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she's trying to make us think it's more valuable than that.
I have a poem about that.
Do you?
It's life is be, do, be, and not do, be, do.
Say that again.
Say that again.
A little louder.
Oh, life is not do, be. No, what is it?
Life is.
Oh, life is be, do, be, not do, be, do. I know, compared to Mary Oliver.
No, I think you should send it to her.
Speaking of being married to a maid.
You've never said that
it's
before.
It's amazing when it comes up.
In contrast, the Dalai Lama recently.
That he's a contrast.
the Dalai Lama recently called his underlings away from their sitting, where they, you know, monastic, entirely alone sitting in caves and mountains. To actually come out into the world and do. And he said himself, if it hadn't been for the invasion from the Chinese, I wouldn't be here, you speaking to an assembly on peace.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting how we're having to meet somewhere in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
He has turned that. We always say, you know, turn your suffering or your... into a blessing.
Mm-hmm.
He has truly done that. You know, he speaks about that all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he would have been in Tibet in this totally isolated, beautiful mountain valley,
mm-hmm.
having this wonderful meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And he's actually calling other support out.
We have a Buddhist monastery in our neighborhood on Whidbey Island, and the monks have a, I can't think of the word, where people are dying.
Oh, hospice.
Yeah, they have a hospice, and the words we've heard from families, it is just, they are just so lovingly taken care of,
mm-hmm.
which is a do, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It comes out of.
Quick comment about the bride and the bridegroom thing. I loved both of them,
mm-hmm.
and I was identifying really strongly with both,
mm-hmm.
not one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's captured something
mm-hmm.
very strong in both.
So she's not saying if you're a woman, read
this
way.
Right. I think the way she's done it, any of us can really... be in the shoes of both images.
Right.
Well, enough
she puts
above.
Herself in that.
Yeah.
I was a bride.
I was
a bride.
Yeah.
Up above, then she has both brotherhood and sisterhood.
Yeah. Yeah. Right next to each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, everyone. This is wonderful for me. And I'm going to close. If you have a minute to hear something, The Leaf and the Cloud, which she wrote in her 60th year of life, to celebrate 60 years of life. That's really amazing. I won't read the whole thing, and that deserves to be read, but I'll read two sections. Because I want you to know that she writes quite a number of poems about nature, but she writes about other things too. My mother was the blue wisteria. My mother was the mossy stream out behind the house. My mother, alas, alas, did not always love her life. Heavier than iron it was as she carried it in her arms, from room to room, oh, unforgettable. I bury her in a box in the earth and turn away. My father was a demon of frustrated dreams, was a breaker of trust, was a poor thin boy with bad luck. He followed God, there being no one else he could talk to. He swaggered before God, there being no one else who would listen. Listen, this was his life. I bury it in the earth. I sweep the closets. I leave the house. I mention them now, I will not mention them again. It is not lack of love nor lack of sorrow, but the iron thing they carry, I will not carry. I give them 1, 2, 3, 4, the kiss of courtesy, of sweet thanks, of anger, of good luck in the deep earth. May they sleep well, may they soften. But I will not give them the kiss of complicity. I will not give them the responsibility for my life. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to skip 3 or 4 sections. This is the final section. When loneliness comes stalking, go into the fields. Consider the orderliness of the world. Notice something you have never noticed before. Like the tambourine sound of the snow cricket, whose pale green body is no longer than your thumb. Stare hard at the hummingbird in the summer rain, shaking the water sparks from its wings. Let grief be your sister. She will, whether or no, rise up from the stump of sorrow and be green also, like the diligent leaves. A lifetime isn't enough for the beauty of this world and the responsibilities of your life. Scatter your flowers over the graves and walk away. Be good-natured and untidy in your exuberance. And in the glare of your mind, be modest and beholden to what is tactile and thrilling. Live with the beetle and the wind. This is the dark bread of the poem. This is the dark and nourishing bread of the poem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I checked out in my name, so but I am